From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. President Bush was on tour this week through Europe, stopping off in Belgium, Germany, and Slovakia, meeting with heads of state, trying hard to bridge a transatlantic gap that has grown ever wider in recent years because of what several key European nations see as American arrogance on issues ranging from the Iraqi invasion to global warming. So we take our own tour of Europe now by way of the foreign press, this week with Susan Caskey, contributing editor of The Week magazine. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So there's been a lot of initial comment on the mere presence of President Bush in Europe, a part of the world he is perceived to have snubbed. What's the reaction there? Were the editorials, I'll give you a choice, appreciative, tentative, or indifferent?
Well, they certainly were not indifferent. There was an element of appreciative. In Le Figaro, a conservative French paper, there was a commentary by Pierre Rousselin where he said, Bush has finally discovered Europe. The idea at Le Figaro and a couple of German papers is that before, Bush knew that there were different European countries, but the EU as an institution that he would have to work with, they felt like he hadn't really acknowledged. But on the other hand, what was different this time around in the reaction to President Bush was kind of a self-deprecating tone in several of the editorials that we normally see in Canadian papers, but haven't generally seen in European papers. In The Guardian, which is a British paper, historian Timothy Garton Ash was quite mocking of the whole European project. He said that on the one side, you had Caesar, this is a quote, on the other, the Prime Minister of Luxembourg and of Belgium and the President of the European Commission and the EU High Representative. And he went on and on in this vein. He was saying that the EU really needs to get it together and have one person who can say, I have the presence, I have the weight of Europe behind me.
When you talk about the self-deprecation, was it limited to Britain?
The surprising place that I found it was in Spain. Prime Minister Zapatero, who is no great friend of President Bush, he's the one who pulled Spanish troops out of Iraq. He only had about 15 seconds of FaceTime with President Bush in Brussels, and the Spanish press was jumping all over him for this and mocking him and saying that he had been dissed. There's a Madrid paper called ABC, ABC, and there was an entire column devoted to the one sentence that President Bush spoke to Prime Minister Zapatero. President Bush said, hola, ¿qué tal, amigo? How are you, my friend? And the Madrid paper just went on and on about that and said, oh, amigo, 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 they're such good friends. When, of course, that was really it. And the rest of it was a snub.
Bush's appearance there was meant as a public relations effort. Did the papers see it that way?
Well, that's an interesting question, especially as regards the visit to Germany, because President Bush came to Mainz and many of the papers, the Süddeutsche Zeitung, but also other German papers, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, mentioned the first President Bush's visit also to Mainz. That was 16 years ago. And at that time, he spoke to cheering crowds. He was talking about German reunification. He really had some interaction with the German people. And this time, the German people want nothing to do with President Bush, and he did not seem to want to engage with them either. Originally, he was scheduled to have a sort of German town hall meeting with German citizens, and that was canceled because there were massive protests. These protests were covered a lot in the German press and not so much in the American press.
In his speech in Brussels, he seemed to strike, at least rhetorically, a conciliatory tone when he called for a new era in European-American relations. Was it reported that way?
It was reported that way to a great extent in French papers, especially. The French economic newspaper, Les Echos, said, we can't really speak of a honeymoon between the U.S. and Europe. That would be exaggerating. But even if it wasn't a true warming, it was certainly the beginning of the end of the Ice Age.
What about the issue of Iran? Right now, Britain, Germany, and France are in negotiations with Iran over its nuclear capability, and the president has declined to join those negotiations so far. But there have been rumors that perhaps America would take military action against Iran. And when he was asked about this in Brussels, Bush said this.
This notion that the United States is getting ready to attack Iran is simply ridiculous. Having said that, all options are on the table.
I think that was perceived as sort of typical diplo speak. But one newspaper in particular, The Times out of London, did pick up on that. And it said the U.S. has the military might to win wars, but it still needs Europe to win the peace. And that's been a theme that we've seen resonating throughout the European press, particularly British and German papers.
Now, as you poured through the papers this week, I get the sense that what you found wasn't really a new opening, a new rapprochement, but more a new acceptance of the reality that this is the American president they're going to have to live with? Or am I being too strong?
No, I think that's absolutely true. There was an editorial in Le Monde that was talking about that exact thing, saying in the first 4 years of the Bush administration, Europe was trying to pretend that this was an aberration, that the Americans weren't really so stupid as to elect someone as right-wing as President Bush. When it happened again, the Europeans then felt like, all right, well, we do have to live with this person. And Le Monde said on the other side, the Americans also have realized that they need to wake up to the fact that Europe exists. It's not going away. It's not always going to agree with them. And that we have to, as Bush said and as Chirac said and Schroeder said and all of them, we have to work together.
All right. Susan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Susan Caskey is a contributing editor of The Week magazine. The New York Times' $410 million purchase of About.com is the latest in a string of old media acquisitions involving internet properties. Dow Jones, which owns The Wall Street Journal, spent more than $500 million to buy MarketWatch.com, and The Washington Post Company recently picked up Slate.com, an online news magazine. And so the question on our minds is, why? Why, when a viable web-based business model has proved so elusive, are established journalistic institutions rolling the dice? Here to answer this question is the executive editor of Forbes magazine, Paul Maidment. Paul, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So it's no secret that ad revenue for print media has been stagnant for several years. One reason is that newspaper readership obviously is declining. But let's talk about another reason. Traditional advertising, though clearly effective, is inefficient.
Lord Leverhulme once famously said, "I know half the money I spend on advertising is wasted. I just don't know which half." If he had been alive today with the web, he would have known which half, because advertising is very trackable, very measurable. It's an incredibly efficient way for an advertiser to reach their audience. So that means you've got the same sorts of levels of advertising, but less money for it going to publishers. And that's bad news for publishers.
So it's not so good for journalism?
Well, I think you've got to think of a completely new way of looking at what journalism is about. And this is something that publishers have had a great deal of difficulty doing. Very few of them have managed to grasp this. And that's this very simple point. What they produce every day is not a website or a blog or a newspaper or, in our case, a magazine. What we actually produce every day is our intellectual property, our journalism. And how we distribute that has to be driven entirely by the demands of our audience. So if they want it in print, we should do it in print. If they want it on a website, we should do it that way. If they want it in person, we should do it that way. But traditional journalism in the sense of reporters going out, finding stories, developing contacts, editors, then processing all that material, that is a very expensive business. And the sort of money that newspapers could get for their advertising in print just isn't coming up at the same level online in order to fund those newsrooms.
Well, then let's examine what the New York Times is doing. Obviously, in purchasing About.com, they're not purchasing a journalistic enterprise. This is basically a network of blogs on some 50,000 different topics. Couldn't the New York Times make more money on the web simply by keeping New York Times information available on the web longer? Normally, you can't find it without paying after about 7 days.
It's my belief in the vast majority of cases, publishers will be a lot better off keeping the content freely accessible and monetizing it by selling advertisements into it rather than charging subscriptions for it. The reason I say that is there is another very fundamental change going on in the publishing industry, in the newspaper publishing industry, and that is this. In the past, what happened was newspapers gathered an audience together and they sold that audience to advertisers, and the audience was happy to pay to be gathered together. They pay a cover price for the newspaper. When the web came along, the pendulum swung a bit. People were still happy to be gathered together as an audience to be sold to advertisers, but now they weren't prepared to pay to be gathered together. They wanted it free. What will happen next is that audience will say, if you're going to sell us to advertisers, then you've got to pay us. And that's the real long-term challenge that I think newspapers are going to be facing.
Paul, I have to say, in the parlance of our times, you have just blown my mind. How is it possible that an audience, any news consumer will say, I've clicked onto your site to, by the way, read news, therefore you owe me?
It may well be that they're not necessarily paid in cash. I don't think that will be the way. But it may be that somehow they're paid in services, they're paid in information.
But they are being paid in information now.
But they're not being paid in information that is necessarily relevant to them. One of the reasons why print circulations are declining is that a generation of people are turning away from print and to the web, because essentially too much in those newspapers doesn't bear on their life at all. They're too generic. And that's the way newspapers have had to be because of the publishing technology for 100 years. So maybe the way that publishers will end up paying to aggregate their audiences is by providing them with highly personalized news services.
We can understand why the Washington Post bought Slate. They're both editorial properties. They could probably move their advertising very easily around in that sphere. But there doesn't seem to be much synergy between the New York Times and About.com.
On the question of synergies, there isn't much, I don't think, crossover between what the New York Times as a newspaper does, a news organization does, and what About.com does. But I think in the New York Times case, they already have largely a free site. So they're getting people coming by and exposed to the advertising, and they're getting paid per 1,000 sets of eyeballs that look at those ads. With the About.com, the advertising is paid for when somebody clicks on a link and actually goes through to the advertiser's site and presumably eventually buys a service. So the New York Times is bolting that second stream of advertising revenue onto what it already has. And that's how it's hoping it will grow its own advertising business.
In 1999, the New York Times bought abuzz.com, which was an online community of topical discussion boards. That site closed shop last year. Mm-hmm. Is this just another expensive blunder?
Well, time alone will tell. Across the internet as a whole, you know, internet 2.0 seems a lot more successful than internet 1.0 commercially. And remember, you know, when the internet bubble burst, it was an internet stock bubble. It wasn't an internet bubble that burst. And a lot of the ideas percolating around then, I mean, publishing ideas, were perfectly valid and strong ideas, and they're now beginning to find their feet.
Do you think that these acquisitions were ultimately inevitable?
Well, if you make your money by selling advertising, you have to be where the advertisers want to be.
Paul, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Paul Maidment is the executive editor of Forbes magazine. Coming up, reporters who pick their way through a minefield of words, and one who lobbed them like missiles to make a point. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. Mostly you wrote in response to our interview with University of Illinois journalism professor William Gaines. With his students, he launched a 4-year investigation into the identity of Watergate's Deep Throat, using clues dropped by Washington Post reporters Woodward and Bernstein. He concluded that their source was former White House counsel Fred Fielding. Carl Nash was one of several listeners who disagreed. He says the source was the late Charles Lichtenstein, a former Nixon staffer. He had access, a connection to Woodward, and experience in undercover work. Nash writes, "The fact that various hints have been given concerning Deep Throat, that he smoked and drank heavily, for example, I take to be attempts to keep Lichtenstein's identity secret. He drank lightly and did not smoke. All of the other candidates mentioned were too high profile or had family or other connections who would have known that he was sneaking out late at night to meet Woodward. And most of them had more to lose by outing Nixon on Watergate than to win." Maybe, but Bob Woodward said he would reveal his source after he died. If Lichtenstein is the man, we should know by now. Constance Hall of Chicago has another suggestion. Quote, years ago I read Deborah Davis's remarkable profile of Katherine Graham in which she made the case that a White House aide with a basement office and regular duties for top officials including Henry Kissinger was perfectly positioned to be deep throat. His name, Richard Ober. And Davis claimed Ober has never denied it. Meanwhile, Laurie Spiegel of the New York metro area wrote in with some political phraseology that she would rather the media not use. Among them, she says that she'd like to replace climate change with global warming. She would change tax relief to revenue reduction. And she says Social Security reform, and by the way, we'll be dealing with that in a minute, should be retired in favor of Social Security modification. Keep those letters coming to WNYC.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. In life, a rose by any other name will smell as sweet. But in politics, an old sneaker can smell like a rose if you convince people, with the help of the media, to call it a rose. Politicians have used words to inspire and seduce since the dawn of nations. Consider the very phrase, Social Security. That program had detractors, but the soothing sibilance of Social Security was music to a nation mired in depression. Back then, the story goes, members of Congress toyed with the phrase economic security, but no, Social Security was best.
From the very beginning, the whole Social Security debate has been caught up in the use of language.
That's Michael Tanner of the Libertarian Cato Institute. He helped shape President Bush's plan to change the program and the language to sell it. Once he liked the phrase private accounts to describe part of that plan, but now the president and much of the media say personal accounts. Tanner says Franklin Roosevelt was just as conscious of the power of words.
Go back even more sort of Orwellian to the Federal Insurance Contribution Act, which is what your Social Security taxes are called. They're certainly not a contribution. They're a tax. And it's not really insurance in any sense of the word. It is simply a tax and a government spending program.
The president wants to change it. He calls it reform. Many in the media have called it reform.
Governor Richardson, on the issue of Social Security reform,
Social Security reform is by far the most politically difficult thing President Bush has attempted.
And Social Security reform. And a lot of Democrats are wondering where you stand on Social Security reform.
Will there be Social Security reform this year?
Well, of course there will be, because the president is defining this issue. People that define the issue determine the outcome, and the outcome.
You just heard CNN, NPR, ABC, and NBC refer to the president's plan as reform. But several news outlets, including NPR, no longer do.
And Democrats opposed to President Bush's plan to overhaul Social Security say if the
On February 8th, NPR Washington editor Ron Elving sent a memo to staff members instructing them to use more neutral words to describe the president's plan.
Reform, if you look at the dictionary, has a strong implication of improvement. To better something. It's a corrective process.
He suggested some substitutes like
revision or change or revamping or overhaul, retooling.
I refer you then back to your dictionary, Ron, because I looked up overhaul and it means to examine for purposes of repair, very much like reform.
You make a good point, and I would re-examine the use of the term overhaul. I do not think that it contains the same implication that a system has to be improved.
Overhaul is also a word used by the New York Times. But reform is a word with a long political pedigree. The Clinton administration made much of what it called welfare reform, but Elving notes, in that case, reporters invoked the R word liberally.
In part because welfare reform was a cause for President Clinton and a cause for the Republican Congress. So neither side of the partisan divide was absolutely opposed to calling it reform.
Same thing with campaign finance reform. Some members of Congress didn't like it, but it was a bipartisan issue in what was amazing in retrospect, a more bipartisan time. Now, as we are often reminded, we are a nation at war. And yet we struggle for consensus on nearly every issue, including what war we're at.
Our late edition web question of the week asked, is the United States winning the war on terror? Here's how you voted. 8%.
CNN is not unusual among networks in applying the phrase war on terror to a range of government activities, including homeland security, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, and sometimes all of them together. That is, after all, how the president sees it.
Our generational commitment to the advance of freedom, especially in the Middle East, is now being tested and honored in Iraq. That country is a vital front in the war on terror.
But some news outlets, including such newspapers as the New York Times, avoid the phrase or put it in quotes. Frequently, though not always, they separate out Iraq, since many disagree over whether that should be considered part of the war on terror. Randy Weissman is deputy editor of the Chicago Tribune, which has recently revised, or should I say reformed, its style book.
When we're talking specifically about money to fund troops who are going to Iraq, we do not refer to that as the war on terror. But when you talk about the entire budget that Bush is looking for, which covers Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda and intelligence gathering information and the war in Iraq, then that whole thing encompasses the war on terror.
Chicago Tribune public editor Dan Wycliffe notes that in the case of Iraq, events have rendered a once questionable term more accurate.
The fact of the matter is, the war in Iraq now may in fact have become part of the war on terror precisely as a result of our invasion and what has happened since then. So semantics have to reflect the reality properly.
At the Associated Press, reporters rarely invoke the war on terror.
I don't think we use it independently. I think when we use it, we are quoting someone else.
AP Stylebook editor Norm Goldstein.
I think the major question about war on terror, strangely, is whether it should be capitalized or not, and we do not.
He who controls the language controls the debate. Political consultant Frank Luntz is a master of Republican phrasemaking. In a Frontline documentary called The Persuaders, he explained how he sold the idea of cutting the seemingly invulnerable estate tax.
For years, they couldn't eliminate it, but the public wouldn't support it because the word estate sounds wealthy. Someone like me comes around and realizes that it's not an estate tax, it's a death tax, because you're taxed at death. And suddenly, something that isn't viable achieves the support of 75% of the American people.
Mindful of the conscious manipulation, most media outlets resist the death tax. But when the president says it, the media must report it. That's the right of every politician, even Democrats, like Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, who coined his own phrase when commenting on the president's economic policies after the State of the Union address.
After we worked so hard to eliminate the deficit, his policies have added trillions to the debt. In effect, a birth tax of $36,000 on every child that is born.
So, reform versus overhaul, private accounts versus personal accounts, the definition of moral values, the definition of the war on terror. These semantic disputes and many others offer proof positive to both sides that the media are biased. I put the question to Chicago Tribune public editor Don Wycliffe. Do media outlets ever adopt language to prove that they're not, you know, biased? Are changes made in the style book in order to
appease? Absolutely not. No. We have an obligation to reality. We have an obligation to certain principles, certain journalistic principles like objectivity and verification. The partisans on both sides have no such obligations.
We asked ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, and The Wall Street Journal to comment on their word choices. They all declined. Most news outlets don't have a formal process for dealing with linguistic landmines like reform, but they do read their mail, and they say they respond to suggestions for more neutral terminology. On several issues, though, they disagreed on what that was. That's not surprising. Neutral words turn acid in the crucible of politics. Under the steady gaze of millions of newly minted media critics, even the best-intentioned journalists can and do get burned. There was a time when reporters did not constantly watch their words. One journalist wrote from the campaign trail in 1972 that, quote, working for Ed Muskie was something like being locked in a rolling boxcar with a vicious 200-pound water rat, and that, quote, there's no way to grasp what a shallow, contemptible, and hopelessly dishonest old hack Hubert Humphrey is until you've followed him around for a while, and that Richard Nixon, quote, speaks to the werewolf in all of us. Hunter S. Thompson, who killed himself last week at the age of 67, was known for taking drugs and firing guns, but he was venerated for his ability to conjure a kind of repertorial hyper-reality. A character based on him recurred in the Doonesbury comic strip and in two films, played by Bill Murray and here by Johnny Depp.
It was time to get grounded, to ponder this rotten assignment and figure out how to cope with it. It was time to do the job. Those of us who had been up all night were in no mood for coffee and donuts. We wanted strong drink. We were, after all, the absolute cream of the National Sporting Press.
Thompson was the gonzo journalist, his phrase, working on the outermost extreme of the new journalism practiced by such writers as Gay Talese and Tom Wolfe, who coined the term. For instance, Wolfe, a caustic social critic, nailed the phenomenon called radical chic after Leonard Bernstein threw a fundraising party for the Black Panthers. Gay Talese took a personal and literary approach to explorations of the mafia and sexuality. He joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What did you write to earn the label of new journalist?
What was new, I guess, to Tom Wolfe, who christened me, was I broke into private life. You see, the fiction writers were the people who wrote about private life. In the 60s, I wanted to write about private life, too, and I wanted to write about people that weren't necessarily newsworthy, or if they were newsworthy, were not in the news. That was taking the tools of fiction, but in my case, writing verifiable nonfiction. I was writing stuff that you could check. If I made up stuff, you could find out. I used real names, no composite characters.
So you could check it, and you put yourself front and center in your well-known books, Honor Thy Father, for instance, and Thy Neighbor's Wife. Thy Neighbor's Wife was about adultery.
That's right.
And you engaged in it.
Oh, well, I'm not going to plead the fifth here, but I'm telling you that I don't stand as St. Francis of Assisi on your show today.
But I mean, it was part of your book.
It was part of my being as well. It was part of my curiosity that could be on a wayward course, but I would go with the momentum. And so did Wolfe do that when he wrote about Leonard Bernstein's cocktail party. And so did Hunter Thompson do that a lot. It is a matter of going in there and taking a chance on being disliked for what you do and taking your lumps and not being afraid.
You really miss that, don't you? That kind of journalism.
Well, I mean, it was for us probably the most thrilling time, because we got away from the rigidity of daily newspapering, which we all came out of. Just the five W's, just the facts, ma'am, that kind of stuff. It was breaking away from that very restrictive mode of just telling what was defined by your elders to be newsworthy. You see, journalism was supposed to be on the sidelines. People in the press box are reporting upon the activities of those who are the performers. In the case of Hunter Thompson, he was one of those who put himself in the story. He was a man who was messing up the territory of other people by his mere appearance. So he was a character, writing about himself as he sees other things in other people.
And in the hands of a master, and I think we would agree Hunter Thompson was, you think you can get somehow closer to the truth of a situation? I recall Frank Mankiewicz, who worked for the McGovern presidential campaign back in 1972, famously said that Thompson's reports from the trail were the least factual and most accurate account of that race.
Muskie was not himself. It was noted that he had developed a tendency to roll his eyes wildly during TV interviews, that his thought patterns had become strangely fragmented, and that not even his closest advisors could predict when he might suddenly spiral off into babbling rages or neo-comatose funks.
What Hunter Thompson did was write about some personages in public life, aspiring characters in the political world, for example, and bring to the vision of them a rather enlarged, if not entirely verifiable, portrait that probably reflected what Mankiewicz means when he talks about a larger truth.
Sometimes a fact is a fact, and it's pretty well known that Hunter Thompson didn't care much about facts. Is it even right to call Thompson a journalist at all?
is it right to call the foreign correspondent in Paris of the New York Times a journalist? Journalism is not objective. So whether Thompson wants to be called a journalist or whether Arthur Sulzberger's whole family is in journalism is debatable. The paper is dominated by the judgment of people who control the print. And so if Thompson or anybody else wants to go on the campaign trail, they have as much right to present what they see and feel and believe to be the private attitude of people who are in the news as anyone who's just dealing with a transcript. I'm not certainly defending Hunter Thompson, and he's not at all what I purport to be. But who cares what I purport to be? You are talking about a particular way of looking at the world, and their eyes and their sensibilities are such that we respect them, or maybe we disagree with them and respect them, or maybe we loathe them because they tell us what we don't want to know.
Yeah, Nixon was always convinced that there was a massive liberal conspiracy to get him. Well, he was right. Yeah, and I was part of that. And I'm proud of it.
We have a message bearer called the late Hunter Thompson, who really did get his point of view across, sometimes with a thrust to the noggin, but it was a strongly wielded piece of work.
Do you find that journalists today are too timid, and do you feel a void in the lack of a voice like Hunter Thompson?
Don't get me started. I can barely read the paper today. I'm so angry. I mean, I think that the Washington press is an all-time low.
Would Hunter Thompson's voice be a kind of antidote to that?
Yes, I would certainly think so. I don't know what they'd do with him. They'd probably bring him up on charges. We wish we would have some courageous, angry, but eloquent voice. We have nothing like that today. Why? Because people are, number one, correct. There is not fear and loathing. There is just fear in journalism of not being on the inside, not getting on the right plane with the president, being X'd out of the circle of power.
Gay Talese, thank you very much.
Okay, Miss Gladstone, thank you.
Gay Talese is regarded as one of the founders of New Journalism and is the author of Honor Thy Father and Thy Neighbor's Wife.
I don't know. I just try to get as close to the what I'm writing about as possible in order to find out what's really happening. And a lot of times it's weirder than it appears in my stories. You know, the truth is usually stranger than fiction.
Coming up, is the truth out there, or are they just conspiracy theories? This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. Women's e-news, news every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy at womensenews.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Hello, I'm Peter Jennings. We begin this program knowing from the research that most of us believe that we're not alone, that there is other intelligent life in the universe.
On Thursday night, ABC's Peter Jennings hosted a two-hour special devoted to one of mankind's most enduring questions. Are we alone? Enduring questions tend to give rise to enduring conspiracy theories.
It's quite natural to wonder about our place in the universe. To suggest that we're alone is inexcusably egocentric.
The federal government knows fully well what is taking place with regard to the UFO phenomenon. They're not sharing that with the American people.
A churlish reviewer in the Denver Post said that Jennings should be covering the Social Security debate instead of hosting a Sweeps Week special. But wait. He notes that if you report a UFO to the government, you will be informed that the Air Force conducted a 22-year investigation that ended in 1969 and concluded that UFOs are not a threat to national security and are of no scientific interest. Some people, people we might call conspiracy theorists, could see that as a classic non-denial denial, a sure sign of a cover-up. Are these people nuts? And if they are, who made them that way?
All the fathers of Nobel Prize winners were rounded up by United Nations military units, all right? And actually forced at gunpoint to give semen samples in little plastic jars, which are now stored below Rockefeller Center underneath the ice skating rink. want to be there for the thaw. Ugh. I mean, it's disgusting. You know what they put in the water, don't you? Fluoride. Yeah, fluoride. On the pretext that it strengthens your teeth. That's ridiculous. You know what this stuff does to you? It actually weakens your will. Takes away the capacity for free and creative thought and makes you a slave to the state.
When the usual mechanisms, media and Congress, for instance, malfunction and fail to adequately inform the public, sometimes citizens take it upon themselves to find the answers. Conspiracy theory has a long tradition as a popular entertainment, for instance, the belief that the moonwalk was faked in a studio. But anthropologist George Marcus of Rice University isn't interested in fringe theorists. He's fascinated by those times when conspiracy theory is taken up by reasonable people to explain real events when the official explanation just doesn't hold together.
It's up to the individual citizen to figure out why the Californians are paying more for energy or why we're in Iraq. And I believe that these basic questions that are with us from day to day and actually have long-term consequences for every one of us and shape our lives require the kind of speculation that conspiracy thinking gives rise to.
But don't you think the media are supposed to be explaining these things?
The media are. But when the media is doing its job in unveiling scandal or questioning the reasons of power, be it private or public, and the answers are not totally clear, people are not just going to leave things as puzzles. They're going to speculate. I don't consider conspiracy theories within this frame of reason or plausibility to be a bad thing at all. I consider it to be one aspect of the right of a democratic citizenry to question or figure out the exercise of power. I consider a little bit of paranoia within reason to be a valuable thing.
Are you suggesting then that perhaps conspiracy theory and the media can nudge each other along? For instance, the conspiracy theory about the control of energy to push up prices in California preceded the actual investigation that suggests that that scenario is actually true. There are a lot of theories about the fall of the Allende regime in Chile, which subsequent investigation turned out to be true. Is there some sort of give and take here?
Oh, absolutely. I think that one enhances the other and that both have a role to play in the functioning of democracy in difficult times.
And is this a difficult time?
Extraordinarily. Well, take the current moment. There is a war going on against hard-to-detect forces that could harm us all, as stunningly initiated by the World Trade Center destruction. And the media is following this and reporting it. But it's all about a secret world of the exercise of power, for which our civil rights have to be qualified or changed so that this work can proceed. And increasingly, as we move away from the World Trade Center, people are becoming very critical and suspicious of their government in the United States. And it seems to me that the media is doing what it can to cover this story. But it is creating as many questions as answers. So by informing, it's fueling a period of uncertainty. But what else could it do? It's doing what it can do.
Professor Marcus, thank you very much.
Thank you.
George Marcus is a professor of anthropology at Rice University and editor of Paranoia Within Reason, a casebook on conspiracy as explanation. That conversation originally took place in November of 2003, and we now know that Professor Marcus was quite right in his remarks about 9/11 and the World Trade Center. Many people are suspicious about what the government says happened that day, and that's led to a lot of theories about the planes, the buildings, and the smoke. The magazine Popular Mechanics set out to apply their expertise in aviation, engineering, and the military to the conspiracy theories, and the results can be found in their March issue. The headline, Debunking 9/11 Lies, Conspiracy Theories Can't Stand Up to Hard Facts. James Meigs is the editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics.
The claims that we looked at range from things like the idea that a guided missile, not a passenger plane, struck the Pentagon, that some kind of military plane, perhaps a tanker or something laden with bombs, hit the World Trade Center, that the plane that hit the World Trade Center didn't have any windows, that the World Trade Center was actually wired with explosives to make sure that it fell to the ground, that a seismograph at Columbia University picked up clear signals of bombs going off in the World Trade Center towers prior to their collapse. Those were the kinds of factual claims and claims that can be checked that we decided to go and basically fact check.
Do you think you would put on the cover of Popular Mechanics, turns out one of these is actually kind of true?
We were hoping we'd come up with something like that. We were hoping that there'd be a grain of truth in there somewhere that would lead to an interesting investigation. The fact is, as a journalist, what you'll see on these sites is the reporting is almost unbelievably sloppy. Things taken from, you know, a newspaper article on September 12th that was immediately corrected the next day. The correction doesn't appear. Just the fact that emerged in the chaotic, disorganized day when everything was happening. And any big story you see, you know, the press gets a lot wrong at first. Gradually, we get closer to the truth. It's never perfect. Popular Mechanics have been criticized in some quarters as focusing on the less plausible claims. We focus on the claims that we found were most prevalent. But what's interesting about the conspiracy theorists is they think anyone who's put out a claim that's less plausible is a government plant. They're doing it on purpose in order to discredit the 9/11, you know, conspiracy theory movement. They're not just confused people. And I think you see this in conspiracy theories, whether it was the anti-communist hysteria of the 50s or the black helicopter crowd in the 80s. They think that the world is far more organized than it really is.
Who's your audience for this? I can't imagine you'll win too many converts among the conspiracy theorists themselves, because in many respects, it's really about how one views the world, your set of core beliefs, and that isn't going to necessarily be altered by an expert from NASA or the FBI.
That's absolutely right. We didn't think we were going to win over the kind of obsessive fringe here. But we're really trying to influence the sensible middle. There's an awful lot of people who have questions about 9/11. These questions are legitimate. We should be investigating it. But we feel that theories that are based on falsehoods don't advance the debate.
I don't want to be contrarian here, but when you talk about a sensible middle, that's rather a slippery location. It seems from the tone of the piece that you came to your own conclusions before conducting the investigation.
No, we didn't come to any conclusions in advance. In fact, you know, there are certain things that conspiracy theorists claim that aren't completely beyond the pale, such as the idea that maybe a U.S. military plane actually shot down the jet Flight 93 over Shanksville, Pennsylvania. I mean, that's not a bizarre thing to wonder about. And if there is evidence that might support that, that's an important thing to look into. So we went into it with an open mind. But when we traced these facts back to the source, they evaporated. They fell apart. I mean, in the case of Shanksville, a lot of websites talk about a mysterious white plane that was seen circling the wreckage. And there's debate as to whether it was an unmarked Air Force plane or it had some kind of electromagnetic device which would have forced the plane down. Well, we located the plane, talked to the pilot. It was just an ordinary commercial flight that happened to be on approach to a nearby airport. The FAA asked it to go in and confirm that a plane had crashed there, and they did that, and they went on their way. As journalists, we do believe that there are facts and that it's our job to look at them, to sort them, and to kind of, you know, in good faith, make sure that the viewpoints that are being put out there do have some factual foundation. And I think that regardless of one's political viewpoint, I think that's what journalism should do, and that's what we were trying to do with this story.
James, I want you to level with me here. Is there an unanswered question in the midst of all your digging? Is there something that was satisfying enough to put in the magazine, but maybe didn't altogether satisfy you?
Where I think more digging is needed is in what the hell went wrong that day. And in the months and years leading up to it, I think that, that's where mainstream journalism perhaps has let us down. And I think the conspiracy theories exploit a very natural and very healthy anger that many people have at our government that we didn't connect the dots, that we didn't manage to head this off, that we didn't protect ourselves. And I think if there's an area that needs to be investigated, that's the area. Conspiracy theorists are touching on that sense of frustration, but they're misdirecting it by, you know, kind of polluting the argument with facts that turn out not to be true and do not support the conclusions that conspiracy theorists are reaching with them.
All right. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
James Meigs is the editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics. Among many others, his article cited Alex Jones, a syndicated radio host and editor of the website Infowars.com. That site offers links to a variety of articles that support what Popular Mechanics would regard as conspiracy theories concerning such topics as 9/11, the New World Order, and the annual meeting of powerful men at Bohemian Grove. Jones's website charges Popular Mechanics with unfairly taking aim at what he calls the 9/11 truth movement. Alex Jones, welcome to OTM.
Wow, thank you for having me on the broadcast.
Why don't you tell me first, what's your principal beef with the Popular Mechanics article?
Well, they build up a straw man. And for those that don't know what a straw man is, you can't defeat the real arguments. So you go in and either misrepresent what your opposition's arguments are, or you construct false arguments and then attack basically a false theory that you can then destroy and discredit. So they build up these straw men and then they knock it down.
Of the 16 items that Popular Mechanics claims to have debunked, how many did you subscribe to in the first place?
Oh, that's a great question. I've actually criticized many of the things they criticize, and much of the body of the 9/11 truth movement actually debate with each other. We're just asking questions. And so they would go out and find the wildest conspiracy theories, and then they would attack those areas and then mix it in with other serious research. And that's what they did here. That's another part of this straw man argument.
Now, Meigs told us that he found that many popular conspiracy theories have sprung from early 9/11 reporting, things that were said that were never really backed up and were later corrected. Do you ever post corrections?
Oh, absolutely. We go back and post new developments, post new articles. We're looking for the truth. And what we do know is that it wasn't just misreporting. We had a lot of government officials putting out lies. And then that's caused a lot of this. But some of it's new. I mean, Rumsfeld in the last year has twice in press conferences, and I'm looking at the AP article in front of me, said that they shot down Flight 93 over Pennsylvania. His head envoy to Canada, it's in the Toronto Star this last Thursday, it came right out and said that they ordered F-16s launched to go shoot down that flight. And then the official story is that they hadn't done that.
Those are all respectable news sources that you quote, but what kind of filter do you use? I mean, you link to articles from the New York Times and the Washington Post and the BBC, but also to sites that are far more out on the fringe. How do you decide what's worthy of a link on your site?
Well, generally, alternative news that we link to is citing other mainstream sources or congressional testimony.
And they often misquote that testimony. Those aren't journalists who necessarily have a responsibility to the truth, but maybe just to prove a point.
The body of what we cover is mainstream news and kind of the things that fall between the cracks. And our track record is excellent on deciphering and exposing 9/11. Really, what we do is we put everything out there except the most extreme government propaganda or the most extreme, you know, conspiracy theories. You can find sites out there that say no planes hit the towers. They were holograms. I think that's government disinfo. We've tracked those individuals back to government employ.
So you're saying that some conspiracy theories are actually being disseminated by the government?
Yes, we in some cases have actually tracked it back to people working for the government. And disinformation is classic. There's been a lot of different congressional hearings back in the late 70s about the government infiltrating the peace movement and putting out disinfo or radical information. Yes, on purpose trying to radicalize the debate so it looks so ridiculous, real, rational, serious people won't even pay attention to it.
Do you object to the terms conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorist?
I really do, because that conjures up images of UFOs and chupacabras, and it's a label, it's a stereotype for anybody that questions authority. I mean, our founding fathers told us to question the government. Common sense in history shows us that the government is more apt to lie to the people than any other institution. And so I think that the muckrakers, call me a muckraker, I mean, I'm out there investigating and cross-checking and really having a memory when it comes to different government stories. And so really what I do is point out their inconsistencies and how their official story has holes in it you can fly a 747 through.
Alex Jones, thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Radio and TV host Alex Jones also edits two websites called Infowars.com and PrisonPlanet.com. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jameson York, and Mike Buolo, and edited by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We also had help from Susanna Dillaplane and Nick Gilowitz, Ed Haber, and Neva Grant. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support for On the Media comes from the New School in New York City, offering an interdisciplinary graduate program in media studies. Fall application deadline March 15th. Information at nsu.newschool.edu/PRI. Also from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.